Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, there you have it. On Your Stay by Samuel Barber. And, you know, if you were driving, I bet your car left the ground with that music. Quite the uplifting piece for me anyway. And it is, of course, there to bring us all into a reflection space, a space to sit back or be on a walk or whatever it is that you're doing and think about what came up in the psychotherapist chair with Stacey. I wonder what you took from that. My goodness, there is so much to take. I couldn't even begin to unpack that. But I want to talk about a couple of things that came up. I'll leave it to you to be inspired by this man, his beautiful honesty, his passion, and his life journey. Very deeply moving, it was at least to me. So what have we got here? Well, I said I'd talk about the world-famous drama triangle, and we referred to it a couple of times in the session. But before we do that, I want to talk about dreaming. Now, you don't have to be Sigmund Freud or Carl Gustav Jung to be able to understand your dreams. All you need to really know is that your dreams are a part of you speaking to you. And I would say as many of our dreams are almost like a part of us passing commentary on our journey through life as an evolving human being. We're becoming more and more aware. That's if we're not being ground down and have entered into a cycle of destruction. And that needs to be broken out of. And one of the best ways to break out of that is to talk to someone like me or to join a group, simply breaking out and not being alone. And deep down, of course, it's your life. Deep down, it's a decision. We talk quite a lot about spirituality. One of the things that rarely gets mentioned about spirituality and certainly about Christianity is that Christianity follows a very clear statement that God gave us choice. Choice to be apart from him, choice to open to him and let him into our heart. Nothing is forced. There's no enforced vaccination when it comes to what the Bible says about Christ and about God. So we have a choice. Life is based on choice. Life is actually decisional. Even when our lives seem surrounded by external forces driving us to survival, we need to understand that how we think of whatever we're going through is entirely and only up to us. Now, of course, there are historical influences, but we're the ones giving homes to those historical beliefs or influences. And what goes on within our own selves is actually down to us. There's a beautiful book, which I have referred to previously, called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, who survived the Auschwitz concentration camps and who reached the remarkable conclusion that even though they were controlling everything about his life, restricting his freedom, it was still up to him how he conducted himself within every task and within every thought that he was having. He was a remarkable man, but what he really pointed out was that anything that happens to us and anything we're going through is completely defined by us, by the meaning and the interpretation that we give it. And this, of course, is captured in the ancient saying of one man's meat is another man's poison. In other words, it really is all about the story we tell ourselves. So remember that when you're having a hard time and just say to yourself, I wonder what meaning I'm giving this particular situation I'm in. And what I want to say about dreams is that they are, as I said, this process by which a more unconscious or subconscious part of us is given expression. And you don't have to be a psychological expert to understand most of the meanings of the dreams. Although when you've listened to as many dreams as I have, it probably helps. But just like anything, the more you do it, the easier it becomes. And don't be persuaded by Freud or any of these other people that think they know what images or symbols in your dreams all mean. They don't. Each dream is couched in your own language of symbology, what things have meaning for you. So how do you dream? Some of you may not dream at all. Well, it's very dangerous not to dream. It's very dangerous indeed. And everyone should be made to dream. I think I said in the session with Stacey that I really encourage all my clients to go and have a dream for me. It's my lighthearted way of saying, giving permission to have dreams. And one of the ways we give ourselves permission to have dreams is have a notepad beside the bed. And whenever you wake up in the middle of the night and you remember you've had this kind of dream, jot it down. Do not go back to sleep. Just jot it down. And some dreams, the really important ones, are with us when we wake up or even get remembered during the day following. We suddenly remember we had this incredible, vivid dream. And don't worry about the ones you forget. Just stay with the ones that stay with you. And imagine that it's a part of you talking to you. It's your inner psychotherapist having a session with you, letting you know how you're doing or what you're processing. Very often, dreams arise when we've actually dealt with a process that we've been grappling with, sometimes for decades. Might just be a few months, but it can be for decades. So top tip number 394 from Uncle Jerry, the psychotherapist, is put a pad beside your bed with a pencil or a pen and don't go back to sleep if you wake having just had a dream. Jot as many of the key images that you can remember down. And then, second part of tip 398, then what you do is you spend a bit of time each day reflecting. Just sit down quietly, put on some music. Hey, put on Samuel Barber. But whatever puts you in a calm space, and just look at the images that are in the dream and start jotting down. If you write the dream down one side of the page, on the other side, start jotting down what certain images might mean to you. Not to Sigmund Freud, not to any therapist, but to you. What do you associate with that particular image? There's the type of dream that confirms and celebrates a completion of a process. And that process may be a 20-year process of finally taking responsibility for your life. There'll be dreams about that if you make that shift. And if you stay in the victim, there might be dreams about that too. But that second group of dreams will be trying to tell you an uncomfortable truth. And so you look at your dreams and you ask yourself, is this a confirmatory dream or is this a challenging dream? And some of the dreams are very challenging. And both of these are useful in my daily work as a psychotherapist. So that's dreams. First of all, record them and then spend a bit of time and reflect on their meaning. But now we're going to move on to the world famous drama triangle. So this is a psychoeducational unit. So get out your pens and paper because you're going to get a free training in one of the most powerful psychoeducational tools that I know of. I've taught this model to thousands of people, and it's really, really effective, especially with the little bit I'm going to add at the end that is of my own addition. Now, where did this model come from? Well, it was written up, first of all, in 1966 by Stephen Karpman. That's Karp as in K-A-R-P-M-A-N, Stephen Karpman. And it was first published in the Transactional Analysis Bulletin. And this particular model that Stephen Karpman came up with has been used in governments, in organizations, in schools, in training colleges, as well as in therapist rooms all over the world. So it's tried and tested, this one. So what is it? What is this drama triangle? Well, I want you just to imagine or draw an equilateral triangle, but not with the big base at the bottom and the point at the top, like the pyramid picture, but invert it. So the point is down the bottom and the base is up in the air. So what you've got is at the apex pointing downwards, you've got the victim. It's like the victim is at the bottom of everything. And certainly that is how the victim sees herself or himself. And then up above, on the baseline of the triangle, which is now above, you've got on the left-hand side, you've got P for persecutor, and you've got R. So let's look at these three different roles. The victim is the great poor me, the great why me, the great why does this always happen to me? And so the victim plays the role of helpless, hopeless, and despairing. The victim is very often accompanied by someone playing the rescuer. Now, the rescuer is trying to help the victim, but very often the rescuer feels in a position where they have to help. That doesn't feel like a real free choice. It feels like something where they actually have to help, or they feel they have to help. And so that means that the rescuer is caught up in, oh, not again. How do I end up, you know, working late night because the boss asked me and I said yes? There can be 101 different ways in which we find ourselves in the rescuer position. It actually means we didn't really choose to be there. We thought we ought to be there. And that builds up resentment and anger, just as the victim place builds up despair and hopelessness. And then the third place is the persecutor, which is when we finally had enough of rescuing or of being a victim, we can flip our position and start having a go at the people who are rescuing us or the people who are we are trying to rescue, the victims. And we find ourselves starting to really give them a hard time. And after we walk away from that exchange, we go, I was a bit heavy on that, or I didn't behave very well, did I? So the persecutor is someone who finds themselves caught up in attacking someone, often because of an accumulation of built-up resentment, which you can see could easily happen either in the rescuer position or in the victim position. I'm fed up of being caught up in this place. So what we see is a rotation or a movement around these three roles. Either I'm feeling poor me, or I'm feeling here I go again, giving up my free time to help other people, or we find ourselves offloading a whole bunch of resentment and having a real go and persecuting someone. Recognize any of these, anyone? In real life, you can talk about this happening, for example, in all sorts of situations. So, for example, not so very long ago, I was on a church trust in the UK, and the accountant left. And so we put out that we needed a new accountant and or someone to be our treasurer, really. And someone volunteered to be our treasurer. Now, that person came in, and to be honest, he didn't really want to be a treasurer at all. He was actually looking for something else. He wanted to have good connections. He wanted to be on the council. He wanted to feel important. He also wanted to have more contact with other human beings. He was a lonely fellow and didn't make friends easy, actually. So we all welcomed him onto the council, the church council, and he starts off doing the council. And we're all kind of happy. But we were a little bit in the victim place because we were none of us were good at this sort of stuff. And when he came, we kind of celebrated him and were very grateful. And it was all lovey-dovey, you know. But it was a game. How do we know it was a game? Because there was a hidden motivation going on for everybody that no one was talking about. He didn't turn up and said, oh, I'm a bit lonely. Can I join your club? You know, he actually said, I'll be useful to you. Some deep childhood belief that he didn't deserve friendship and that he had to be helpful to people. I wonder if there are any listeners out there who grew up realizing that the only way they could get attention and appreciation was being useful and effective. Oldest children often get that role, but there's a lot of different ways that can happen. And so everything went on for a while, but then, of course, he got fed up. And so he started to go into a complaining mode. And he started going, oh, I've so little time. I can't do all this. I've got this and this. And he started to whine and moan a bit in the victim position. And really on the council, no one took any notice. Not very Christian, I suppose, but I mean, there was a few sympathies, but we were all doing different things and we'd all agreed to be there. And so we were getting on with our jobs. And when it came to the meetings, it became a little bit tedious now because the meetings got a bit soggy. I call them soggy meetings, where the treasurer would start to lament how hard it was to do what he was doing. And, you know, we'd say there, and you're doing a wonderful job, and that's all right, you know. You know, you're a bit late on getting that bit ready for us, but we're all nice people, so we'll allow all that, no big problem, you know. And in a sense, as he played the victim role, we started to become his rescuer, allowing him off the hook quite a lot for things that he'd agreed that he would do. So, and things seemed to be getting more and more complicated for him. And then what began to happen was when someone needed their expenses paid, it was like, no, I can't possibly do that. I'm not coming near my computer for the next 3 weeks. You'll have to wait. And every contact and communication with this person became really kind of, ow, that was a kick. We got a kick in TA. It was like, ow, you put the phone down afterwards and you go, ouch, that wasn't very nice. And you know, he became this really quite nasty person who no one wanted to talk to, which, of course, was what he came in with. That was his ancient familial pattern. But, you know, I wasn't his psychotherapist at the time. And in truth, I didn't really clock what had gone on until after it was all over. And then, of course, the denouement of this process was that in the end, he threw a big wobbler and said he was walking out and he couldn't do this anymore. And it was and that was it. And he stormed off. Well, that was all very well, but he got extra persecution from this because he was able to not hand over the accounts to the next person who volunteered to do it. And so there was a 3 month to 6 month period in which the person who was meant to be taking over the position couldn't actually get the passwords or the account numbers or open up a bank account. It was a nightmare. And all the time, the person that had stepped in as the rescuer, become the victim, became the persecutor. And that just gives you a real life example of how these drama triangles work out. And I promised that I would give you my own little toolbox for, as it were, stepping out of the drama of the drama triangle and hopefully reaching greater self-autonomy and responsibility and healthier interaction with other people. So get your notebooks out because here it comes. And I'm going to start with the rescuer role. How do we move from the rescuer to genuinely being a person that can help other people if we choose to do so? So one of the key points here is if you are wondering about helping out someone, there's just five questions. In fact, there are five questions almost identical for every single role. The first question to ask yourself is, did this person or the organization that I'm thinking of helping specifically and explicitly ask me for my help? Very often we feel, as it were, compelled to help people because that was our identity as children. So were we asked for help? Very often we find ourselves caught up in offering help before it's even been asked for. I certainly know that one very, very well. The second question to ask people is, does this person really need help or can they do it themselves? In other words, am I dealing with someone who actually needs help or am I dealing with someone that believes they ought to have help? There's a difference. And the people playing the victim position are often those people. So you don't need to engage with someone that's asking for help when, in fact, they actually don't need to. It's something they can do themselves. What would be a good example of that? Someone who says, I need help to clear my house. No, you don't. You just need to get on with it. And maybe the help you need, more than anything, is to be told to get on with it. I don't know why you're living in such a chaotic, messy house. You're better than that, and it'll just take you a weekend of sorting, maybe several weekends, if you're a clutter person. Does this person really need help, or can they do it themselves? Asking the third question, which is, okay, am I the right person to be helping them? If someone wanted help with gardening, do not ask Jerry Pives, okay? Or even DIY material, you know, because I can pretty much guarantee that if I were to help you with any DIY stuff, then putting up a bunch of shelves would end up to needing a whole house renovation. I would find a way probably to find the one place where if you hit it with a hammer, the rest of the house falls down. I have a knack for that. So I am DIY dyspraxic. DD. Anyway, no DSM version for that yet, but I'm sure they'll come up with it and give me a bunch of drugs I can take. Anyway, am I the right person to be helping them is the third question you ask them. And then really, really, really important, possibly the most important question of all to me is, can I say no? In other words, is this my decision to help them, or am I being covertly manipulated into helping them with a poor me story? Can I say no? If you can't say no, then you cannot say yes. Now, I am determined to get around New Zealand and be running workshops at some point in the future. And one of those workshops will be how to say no and how important it is to say no. In fact, your very survival depends on saying no. Practice saying no to a few things. I know that doesn't sound very nice or polite, but it may be the very essential part of your survival in these challenging times. You've got to have your own space. You've got to have your own time. You've got to have your own resuscitation and recreation. You'd be amazed how reactive some people get when you say no. And that's when you realize you weren't meant to say no. There was no real sense of it being your choice. No, it was a manipulation or indeed a controlling interaction with someone. They're trying to control you with their poor me. And that's why in my own version of teaching this, I actually draw it with the victim at the top of the pyramid. At the top, I put it back the way we draw a pyramid. And I put the victim at the top because very often it's the victim that's pulling the strings of everybody else in the drama triangle. More of that another time. Fifth question and final question. Will my help lead to greater independence and autonomy for them? Will they be able to get on with their own shit better as a result of my help? That's a really important one. I mean, the analogy there is, of course, rather than send fresh water to a country that has got polluted supplies or got a drought, we send the equipment for them to dig a well so they can provide themselves with their own water. So that's the rescuer. Goodness me, this is a big subject, isn't it? All of this I call how to step out of the drama triangle. And of course, if you successfully step out of the drama triangle as a rescuer, you are then confronted with all your historical training and conditioning and programming to always be the most useful person. So do not expect to feel comfortable. At no point did any of these questions ask, will I feel comfortable doing this? And you may say yes, but it's very important that you can answer all of those five questions before you say yes. Just asking yourself those five questions. Now, a very similar group of five questions relate to the persecutor. If you find yourself frequently getting into the persecutory position, you might find yourself giving your judgment or opinion to people, and it might not be a very nice opinion. So the first question is, was my opinion or my reaction or indeed my behavior actually asked for at any point? And I can pretty much guarantee if you're in the triangle, it was not. Question number two, will my input make a difference? And again, if we're just getting off on giving someone a hard time, it probably will only make the situation worse. Well, that'll be a difference. I think it should say, will my input make a positive difference to the situation? Thirdly, am I the right person to be giving advice? If there is some kind of issue around which my judgment is needed, am I the right person? Very often, instead of getting caught up in the persecutor, I tend to say, I think you should go and ask someone like a local lawyer or a nurse or a doctor about these things, not me. Okay, fourth question, is my input appropriate and measured? Look, if the person is getting themselves into trouble for something that they are doing, is it really measured for me to be screaming at the top of my voice or slamming doors in their faces? So that's always an interesting question to ask yourself. And finally, the fifth question is, again, is my input likely to prevent a repetition of this situation for them? In other words, are they actually going to learn what they need to learn? And if not, why would I get involved? So those are the five questions if you want to challenge yourself and you find yourself in the persecutor position. And very often, those of us that do find ourselves in the persecutor position have been in the rescuer or the victim position and built up a whole bunch of tough feelings, resentments that we need to, as it were, offload. And we're talking about going from being a persecutor to really a wise elder, someone who can give support and advice to someone, just as the rescuer can turn into the grown-up adult helper of choice. We can actually not only help as an adult, we can help them to become more adult about solving their situation. So finally, we come to the victim position, which is the poor me position. And if we find ourselves caught up in this, very often we know it because we feel rather hopeless and helpless, and we're whining a lot. We even get a little bit bored of the sound of our own voice. So the five questions for the victim are, number one, did I explicitly ask for help? You see, very often the victim position is won, like we're in a game. The victim position is won by the person who manipulates other people to help, doesn't explicitly say, could you please help me clean my house out? You know, that's a very explicit statement and a request for help, yeah? That leads us on to the second question we ask ourselves is, do I really need help or could I just sort this out for myself? Is it time to step up, face up and get on with solving, clearing my house, for example? Is this the right person to ask? Asking my 80-year-old grandmother to help me physically clear stuff out of a house might not be the best idea, but I'm just used to being rescued by her. Okay, poor old grandma. Okay, fourth question. Can the person I'm asking say no? Is it okay for them to say no? Because what you'll find is if you're in a victim place and they say no, you very quickly can move to the persecutor position. You see, every time I ask you, you just refuse. You don't care for me. And off we go and we start attacking them. So is it okay? If you ask someone, it should be okay for them to say no. After all, they have their life and you have yours. If you ask for help, that is something you have every right to do, but you don't have any right to control their reaction. But if they can't say no, they can't possibly say yes. And trust me, if they can't say no and they come and help you, they're going to come in as the rescuer role and they're going to start resenting you and probably very rapidly move to the persecutor position. That's quite common. Finally, the fifth question, by asking this person, will it mean I am more able to help myself in the future? Sometimes it may well be that I need help in clearing my house because I grew up with the idea that life had to be chaotic and we weren't meant to know where anything is, which means, of course, we spend most of the day looking for things. And it may be that in order to really face this one and get on with it, I do need some help, but it needs to be someone who is very good at sorting things out and who I can learn from. So instead of being the victim, we become a grown-up learner, a true student of life, where we look at people who have something that we've missed out on developmentally in our background, in our childhood, and we say, you know, I really could do with a bit of that. Would you help me with it? And that's it. Five questions to ask yourself and avoid being in the drama triangle. But in each of those places, remember, the minute you step out of those places, you will be confronted with some level of discomfort. Discomfort of habit, it's because you may not be used to it. These are the patterns of behavior that we grew up with often, so they're not so easy to break apart. So do not give yourself a hard time if you start discovering you're back in these games and it takes a little bit of time and practice. At first, we generally only realize we got caught up in a game when we're completely at the end of it. And over time, you find yourself noticing in the middle of it. And then after a little bit more time, you'll actually find yourself about to go into a game and you'll catch yourself. What happens when you stop doing all the drama? You get on with life. You don't waste your time and energy on stuff that gets you nowhere. Except psychologically, it is doing something, but it's repeating a destructive pattern. And you'll find yourself able to spend your time and energy focusing more on the things that matter to you in your life.
Thanks for tuning in to Ask.